Welcome to the Daily Stoic Podcast, where each weekday we bring you a meditation inspired by the ancient Stoics, a short passage of ancient wisdom designed to help you find strength and insight here in everyday life. And on Wednesdays, we talk to some of our fellow students of ancient philosophy, well-known and obscure, fascinating and powerful. With them, we discuss the strategies and habits that have helped them become who they are and also to find peace and wisdom in their actual lives. But first, we've got a quick message from one of our sponsors. I'm just about to go into the studio to record my latest audiobook. My wife and I have been listening to audiobooks. We've been listening to audiobooks in the car as a family just to keep our kids off screens because Audible is amazing. And Audible is also the destination for thrilling audio entertainment with highly anticipated new releases and next to listen recommendations to satisfy every type of thriller listener. If you want breathtaking, sinister, and shocking tales that will enthrall you, even brand new and exclusive thrillers from best-selling authors, well, then you want to check out Audible. My wife and I were just raving about this true crime audiobook that we read called Furious Hours. And then I've been raving about this book, Night of the Grizzlies, which I loved. Audio piques the imagination and it brings thrillers to life. And as an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from the entire catalog. Visit audible.com/dailystoic or text dailystoic to 500-500. That's audible.com/dailystoic or text dailystoic to 500-500. Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business and evolving your passions. We push what technology can do so great ideas can happen now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to now. And now we do what is necessary. This is a time of uncertainty. It is a time of change. It is a time when options have been eliminated, when hard choices are being made. What does a Stoic do when they've lost their job, when their income has dropped by half, when they've had to bury a sibling or a grandparent or shutter a business, close out a dream? They do what is necessary. This is a constant theme in Marcus Aurelius's Meditations. Here was a man supporting a large family with a difficult job, facing a plague, facing enemies, facing his own ill health. Yet time and time again he reminds himself, my priority is to be good, my duty is to serve. I will not waver, I will not quit, I will not be heard complaining, I will keep going, unswerving, to the finish line. In his time, this is what it meant to be a man or to be a Roman. But the Stoics knew that there was nothing gendered or nationalistic about those four critical virtues of courage and justice and moderation and wisdom. There was nothing ancient about them either, because they are what you are called to do today. Because the answer to that question you and so many people are forced to ask yourself, what do you do? Well, you must do what is necessary. You must be brave, good, wise, and self-disciplined today and always. Hey, it's Ryan Holiday. Welcome to another episode of the Daily Stoic Podcast. As you know, I am a longtime runner. I've been running pretty much every day since, I don't know, fifth grade. That's when I started running, maybe earlier, third or fourth grade. I ran track in middle school, ran track cross country in high school. I didn't take it super seriously. It wasn't until college that I really got into it. And now I run almost every single day. If you've read any of my books, well, then you have experienced the benefits, I guess, of me running, because I do a lot of my writing running. I tend to work in the morning, try to write, not always successful. But when I go for my run in the afternoons, usually, although this morning I ran in the morning, I tend to work out a lot of my problems on the road. And there's a lot of history of runners and writers, but also going back to the ancient Stoics, there is a long connection between running, writing, and thinking. Not only does Seneca say that we should take wandering walks because walks help relax the mind, a mind that is too focused, Seneca says, will break. Let me read you this passage from Lives of the Stoics about Chrysippus. It gives you some connection between the history of Stoicism and running. What is the connection between philosophy and running? There is none. But between Stoicism, a philosophy of endurance and inner strength, of transcending one's limits and of measuring oneself against a high internal standard, distance running, Here, the overlap is profound, particularly for a young man like Chrysippus, Soli Cilicia, competing for the first time in an Olympic distance race like the Dolichos. I'm so bad at these words. I'm just not even going to apologize for how bad I am. A three-mile race for which there is no modern equivalent. This was not a three-mile loop like a modern cross-country course or even a track event like the 5,000 meters, but instead consisted of approximately 24 stadium lengths done almost like wind sprints on a basketball court. It's not hard to imagine this stoic mind forming as its molder. Chrysippus ran as hard as he could, back and forth, not only trying to beat other racers, but trying to convince himself to keep going as he heaved for air and his brain told him to stop. As he jostled for the lead in a pack of runners, he was unconsciously developing the ethical framework that would direct his life and the future of the Stoic school. Runners in a race ought to compete and strive to win as hard as they can, Chrysippus would later say, but by no means should they trip their competitors or give them a shove. So too in life, it is not wrong to seek after the things useful in life, but to do so while depriving someone else is not just. But mostly it would have been on the long training runs by himself through the coastal plains of his homeland in what is today southern Turkey. Chrysippus prepared himself for the challenges that life had in store for him and for the feats of intellectual and physical endurance that philosophy would demand. So anyways, the connection between Stoicism and running, particularly endurance running, goes way back. And my guest today, Dean Karnazes, has pushed his body beyond all limitations that you can imagine. He's run 50 marathons in all 50 states on 50 consecutive days. He's run across Death Valley in the middle of the summer. He's run a marathon to the South Pole. He's competed in 200-mile relay races solo. He's the winner of the award for the world's toughest foot race. He's run the Badwater Ultra Marathon. He's won the Four Deserts Challenge. He's raced in the hottest, driest, windiest, coldest places on Earth. I think most interestingly connected to what we're going to talk about today, he's also run from Athens to Sparta, eating and running like an ancient Spartan in his ancestral homeland. I don't know, just an incredible athlete, pusher of human limits, and the author of many, many books. He's written a book, as I said, about his journey from Athens to Sparta called The Road to Sparta, reliving the ancient battle and epic run that inspired the world's greatest foot race. He's written a book called 50-50, Secrets I Learned Running 50 Marathons in 50 Days. He's written the book Ultra Marathon Man, Confessions of an All-Night Runner. And his new book, A Runner's High, My Life in Motion, is out now. And we have this awesome conversation about pushing oneself, about limits, about listening to that little voice inside you, but also not listening to that little voice inside you. Talk about reading, talk about challenges, talk about self-discipline, talk about addiction. Anyways, it was a great conversation. I was really excited to have it. Check out Dean's new book, A Runner's High, My Life in Motion. You can also go to his website, ultramarathonman.com. You can follow him on Instagram at Ultra Marathon. His screen name is Ultra Marathon. And here's my conversation with Dean. I hope you like it. And go for a run or a swim or a bike ride while you listen, perhaps. But if you can't do that, like I can't, I don't like to listen to talking during my workouts. Do it later. Definitely do it. Talk soon. All right. So my first question for you is, as someone who's been a longtime runner, do you find that the physical benefits are greater than the mental benefits or the other way around? I go back and forth as to whether the running is, I'm almost indifferent to the physical benefits of running. And to me, it's almost entirely a mental endeavor at this point.
that's a funny question to open with because, you know, I'm 100% Greek and I don't delineate between the two. The physical and the mental to me are, you know, they're one and the same. You know, if I was to say which one benefits more, it's hard to distinguish. I think, you know, physical health leads to mental health and mental health helps you get more physically active.
Yeah, well, I would imagine too, in your case, it might even be a stronger stronger case for the mental benefits, and that there's probably something slightly unhealthy about the extreme feats that you put your body through. But I imagine there's also a part of you that would lose your mind if you were to stop doing them.
I mean, I think the mental benefits for day-to-day living are pretty pronounced, but as well as the mental benefits of pushing yourself, you know, to the edge and over the edge, I think are also something important to me. You know, the Oracle of Delphi said, know thyself. And mm-hmm. How do you get to know thyself? Well, to me, you push thyself into these extreme conditions. And there's a race I do called the Western States 100-mile endurance run. And they say you run the first 50 miles with your legs and the next 50 miles with your mind.
I love that because, yeah, I think when people hear that idea of know thyself, it's sort of like sit down and listen to that little voice inside you. But I think one of the things you learn running, particularly as you push distance, if you run somewhere where it's real hot, you kind of learn that voice is a fucking liar and you shouldn't listen to it.
I can think of no other sport that holds a mirror up to you the way running does. You know, you see through, you know, all your falsities. There's no lying to yourself when you're running.
Yes. But it's weird because that voice is lying to you in the sense that that voice is like, you should quit, you should stop, you can't go any further. This isn't working. Also, I love like sort of on the more day-to-dayness of it, there's that voice before you get up to run, before you put on your shoes, that maybe says, you won't enjoy this. It's too hard. Don't do it. But in fact, I feel like I've never left my house for a run and come back and been like, I regret doing that. Almost invariably, I'm glad I pushed through and got to that place. But if you just listen to the voice, if you just sort of know that superficial self, it can actually prevent you from doing a lot of good stuff.
Well, you know, some days when I don't feel like running, you know, I basically say this is really going to suck and I'm going to enjoy it. Like I'm really going to dive into the low and, you know, experience the full emotional range of something that's horrible. And let's face it, you know, not every run is pleasurable.
But no.
Yeah. But I mean, to your point, I've never once come back from a run feeling worse than I did before I ran.
Although, and I might be jumping ahead, I have so much to talk to you about, but I do feel like part of what makes you great, and I think anyone great at what they do, is that sort of drive that pushes past the resistance, that ignores, you know, the voice that says stop, that the self-discipline to sort of not just do the marathon, but to do the marathon of life, of sort of doing it every day. Right. To not quit, to stick with the practice routine, to stick with the training regimen, et cetera. Isn't there also this tricky thing to go back to this idea of the voice, which is that sometimes you have to blow past the voice because the voice is lying. Other times you have to listen to the voice because the voice is telling you that if you push any further, you're about to get hurt. Right. So how do you balance that tension between pushing and listening?
I think you're asking the wrong guy that question. I mean, I've literally pushed myself into exhaustion. You know, I've collapsed on the roadside from not knowing where that line is. You know, when you start seeing stars, you know, and your extremities start to tingle, maybe that's a good sign that you should back it down.
do you have kids?
I do. I have two kids.
So maybe that's another good place for this tension, right? It's like you can push yourself very hard, but then that same virtue can become a vice because you have trouble listening to other. I'm not saying you do, but it can the double-edged sword of the drive of pushing past the resistance is, how do you know when to stop? How do you know when to listen? How do you know sort of moderation even within the drive and the commitment? You know, in the NBA, they're working on load management, for instance, because so often, you know, injuries are caused by overtraining, by pushing past those reservations. And then this is also true, I think, with teammates, with children, you know, like sort of how do you find balance within the insanity?
Well, I mean, I think balance is somewhat of a misdirected goal. I think I found a state of harmonious imbalance.
Okay.
You know, let's face it, when when you're living life to its fullest, it's pretty frenetic, especially in our society. There are a lot of moving pieces and, you know, not everything is in balance. But I think that if you can find harmony in the imbalance, that's a better approach. I think we live in an imbalanced, you know, very unbalanced society. And, sure. You know, unless you're a monk and go, you know, off and live in the hills, you're going to have to navigate through it. And it's hard to keep that balance when, you know, everything is so disrupted around you.
I think that's right. And it's also hard to be great at anything and be balanced, right? Because to be great requires an obsessive commitment to one thing, usually at the expense of some other things.
Yeah, I mean, I think that every ultra runner has a fanatical drive. You know, what else would push you to go run for, you know, 15, 20 hours nonstop unless you're, you know, pretty fanatical about it?
What is that drive for you? What makes you do that?
You know, I have a fascination with how far the human body can go to kind of test and expand the limits of human endurance. And I've consistently proven to myself that, you know, I can go further than I thought I could. And, you know, maybe I'm better than I thought I was. You know, when someone initially told me about a 100-mile foot race, I didn't believe it. I thought there was trickery involved. I thought, you know, there are hotels along the way or campgrounds. And the guy said, no, buddy, the gun goes off and you start running and you stop when you cross the finish line, which hopefully is within 24 hours. And I simply couldn't get my head around the idea of running 100 continuous miles. I didn't like running a mile and I didn't like driving 100 miles. But when I went and did it, you know, I proved to myself that, you know, maybe fewer things are impossible than what you thought.
Is that what's on the other side? Like what sort of epiphany or awareness or understanding comes from repeatedly pushing and breaking the sort of notions of what is or isn't possible?
Well, I mean, the other thing that I talk about this in my new book is, you know, you can achieve in 24 hours of running what takes a monk a month of meditation. You know, you slowly whittle down and, you know, pretty much eviscerate the ego. And to me, that's very cleansing. And it's rare that we live in a kind of egoless state. But when you're running these great distances, you know, you're just forced to be in the here and now. It's so commanding that you have to be in the present moment of time and just doing the very best you can in that instant. And to me, that's, you know, it's like a Zen-like state you can get into, like a zone. And, you know, when you emerge from that, it's almost like a rebirth.
I totally agree. People sometimes ask me, like, you know, do you meditate? And I go, no, but I do run, bike, swim, and walk a lot. I find that, like, sort of because I am frenetic and kind of high energy, that meditation is very difficult and doesn't sort of generate the results. But yeah, I've never gone on a run and not come back in a more zen-like state than I was before I left. You know, invariably, I've slowed down, I've been present, I've unlocked something in my brain that I didn't even know I was working on. You know, often, like, I tend to wake up early, you know, do my writing, and then it's on my runs in the afternoon that I unlock or solve the problems that I was stuck with, you know, several hours before writing, because my subconscious got to work on it while I was on the bike or in the pool or on the trails.
Yeah. I mean, there's a saying, motion stirs emotion. And I couldn't agree with you more. In fact, I do a lot of my writing while I'm running. Mm-hmm. Because to your point, we have some of our clearest thoughts when we're running. And, you know, I used to try to remember passages, you know, to write about in like when I was working on various books, and inevitably I'd forget something. So I just now dictate into my phone, and then I put in an earbud and type up the, you know, the dictations. And inevitably when I read them, it's like, wow, this is pretty good. Like, this is a lot better than I ever could have produced, you know, just sitting on my rump in front of a computer.
Totally. Yeah. I was at a pool once and about to get in, and someone recognized me and said, oh, you know, you're Ryan Holiday. I just read your book. And I said, yeah, you know, I wrote it in this pool. And they were like, what? You know, that was inconceivable, but I'd read it doing laps. And I almost have my wife and I have sort of an unspoken agreement that, like, when I come home from a run, like, don't talk to me until I say something first, because I don't do the dictation thing for you. I'm trying to get home and dry off enough, you know, so I don't get sweat all over the pad or whatever. I've got to get those thoughts onto the page as soon as possible before I lose them. But they're often some of the best stuff that ends up going into the books because, yeah, it came from a different place than trying to intentionally work at the computer.
Well, I'm glad I'm not the only one that does that to my wife. It's so funny you're describing that because I all the time that happens. I come through the door and I'm like, hold it, let me just write down these couple things. And it's so funny to hear you do the same. You've done the same.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and I think it's like, so the thing pops in your head and then you're like, I can't forget that. So then you're repeating it to yourself over and over. So, you know, I can do like maybe three or four things. Like if I come up with 10 things, like I'm going to forget some of them, but it's almost like it's almost like you're trying to remember a poem or something. Like you're having to repeat it like a mantra to yourself. It's kind of just, there's almost something different than the spontaneity of writing at the computer where you had to like get it into your mind as you're doing the rhythm of the steps. I don't know. There's something different about it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think we're not the only ones that have discovered this. Like, you know, Thoreau is notorious for, you know, walking around, like walking for 10, 12 hours. And, you know, I mean, I'll go back to the ancient Greece, because since I'm Greek, you know, Aristotle, you know, his students were known as the Peripatetics because they literally, you know, they wandered around Athens as they were, you know, as he was lecturing and as they were doing some of their deepest thinking.
Well, I wanted to tell you, I don't know if you know this, but one of the early Stoics is a guy named Chrysippus, actually was a runner. He was a distance runner, but in a weird way. I'll get the word wrong, but it's called the it's D-O-L-I-C-H-O-S. And basically it was a distance run, but you did 24, 25 stadium length laps. So it was 3 miles of essentially like mid-length wind sprints. And I just love the idea of a philosopher, you know, sort of also struggling with an extreme endurance sport, you know, because we tend to think of philosophers as these intellectual people, yeah, even the Thoreaus, as these kind of softies. You don't think of you think of Aristotle in his flowing robe. You don't think him, you know, like lacing up his sandals for 10 miles of walking. But actually these were active people. And I think a lot of the best ideas come from some form of activity.
Yeah, no, I couldn't agree more. I mean, Aeschylus, again, is another prime example. I mean, you know, he fought in the Battle of Marathon and he was an athlete and, you know, he's, you know, some of his thoughts were profound.
Yeah, you realize that the sports metaphors, whether it's wrestling or boxing from the Stoics, are probably not, you know, sort of Monday morning quarterbacking. Like they actually did participate in those sports because it was considered such an essential part of, you know, Greek and Roman life. Like to be a pen and ink philosopher for the Stoics was like to mean that your philosophy wasn't worth anything. Like it actually had to be tested in the ring or, you know, on the race course. And yeah, I don't know how many Harvard professors are also, you know, sort of hardcore endurance athletes, but I imagine their philosophy would be better if they were.
I agree. I mean, there's an African proverb, you know, when you pray, move your feet. And I just think there's something about movement that is inherent in the human animal.
So speaking of sort of this connection between history and running, talk to me about this Spartan race you did, a literal Spartan race, not an obstacle course race, but talk to me about the run from Sparta to Athens.
Yeah, well, it was somewhat of a history project. I mean, I think a lot of people have run a marathon, and certainly everyone, you know, the word marathon is pretty ubiquitous. But not everyone knows the meaning of marathon or why the marathon is, you know, 26.2 miles. So I kind of wanted to delve into that. So I worked with a gentleman by the name of Professor Paul Cartledge. And Dr. Cartledge is from Cambridge University, and he's one of the foremost authorities on ancient Greek culture. And he helped guide me through learning about this class of citizen in ancient Greek called the dromi, which basically means day-long runner. And these guys were professional foot messengers. And the Greeks realized in the rocky and mountainous, you know, terrain of southern Greece that a human could outrun a horse. And in fact, Pheidippides, the original marathoner, is the translation of his name is spare the horse. Because, you know, why kill a horse when you can just go have this guy run and, you know, deliver messages or gather intelligence from various city states? So what happened before the final marathon is that Pheidippides ran from Athens to Sparta to recruit the Spartans into battle. The Persians had invaded at the Bay of Marathon. And if you've ever seen, you know, the movie 300, you know who the most badass fighting force in ancient Greece was. That was the Spartans. So Pheidippides ran 153 miles from Athens to Sparta to tell the Spartans the Persians had invaded and they, you know, the Athenians needed reinforcement. And to me, you know, that in itself is an amazing endeavor. And this is 2,500 years ago. So I went to recreate that. Like I said, I gotta see how this guy possibly did it, you know, eating only figs, olives, cured meat. And the ancient athletes used to eat something called pastilli, which was ground sesame seeds and honey. So I took on the endeavor of running this race, only eating those foods. And, you know, the other thing that just was so astounding to me is that, you know, I'm using a GPS.
Right.
You know, I'm following a road with a lot of markers and, you know, actual trails. You know, he was self-navigating. I mean, there was no GPS. And, you know, Herodotus said he arrived the day after setting out, which can be interpreted as, you know, sub 36 hours. So somehow a guy 2,500 years ago ran, you know, basically a grueling ultra marathon in a time that's hugely respectable in this day and age.
And did he do it in sandals or what kind of footwear do you think it was?
It's pretty unclear. He could have been barefoot. There's nothing in the record that talks about what he wore, but there is other references in the record talking about criminals getting away from the authorities by taking off their sandals and running barefoot. So it's unclear whether he wore leather sandals or just ran barefoot.
And what when you did it, did you do it in running shoes or what did you do it in?
Yeah, no, I wore you know, well-designed modern running shoes. Yeah, I ran a marathon barefoot to see what it was like. I ran the Silicon Valley Marathon barefoot, and I'll tell you what, Ryan, I couldn't walk for a long time after that.
Got a quick message from one of our sponsors here, and then we'll get right back to the show. Stay tuned.
I've talked a lot about my morning routine here. One of the things I do every morning after I get up is I take a bunch of vitamins that my doctor recommended after some blood tests. I take a vitamin C, a zinc, a omega-3, and I take a couple others who I'm forgetting, but I definitely know whose vitamins I take. And they actually happen to be today's sponsor, and I've been taking them long before Thorne sponsored today's episode. Thorne takes a personalized, innovative, and scientific approach to health and wellness with all their supplements, and they've teamed up with leading medical professionals to bring out highly effective nutritional supplements. Because I'm a runner, I'm always trying to take care of my joints. And with Thorne, I never have to question what's in each supplement. Give your body what it really needs with Thorne. Go to thorne.fit/dailystoic and use code dailystoic for 10% off your first order. That's thorne.fit/dailystoic and use code dailystoic for 10% off your order. thorne.fit/dailystoic. Use code dailystoic. And note, these statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Hims is changing men's healthcare by providing access to affordable sexual health treatments from the comfort of your couch. It's always sensitive talking about these things, but Hims is changing men's healthcare by providing access to doctor-trusted ED treatments such as chewable hard mints, brand name treatments like Viagra, or generic alternatives for up to 95% cheaper. The process is simple and 100% online. No uncomfortable doctor's visits. If prescribed, your medication ships to you for free. No insurance needed. Start your free online visit today at hims.com/TDS. That's hims.com/TDS for your personalized ED treatment options. Hard mints are a chewable compounded products
which are not approved by or verified for safety or effectiveness by the FDA. Prescriptions require an online consultation with your healthcare provider who will determine if appropriate restrictions apply. See website for details and important safety information. Subscription required. Price varies based on product and subscription plan.
Yeah, I just walked out to throw out some trash and where my office is, and I don't wear shoes like in the office usually. And I almost stepped on a rusty nail, and I was like, you know what? Even if the benefits of barefoot running are better, I think they invented shoes less for the health, less for the benefits for running exactly, and more for the reality of the world that we live in.
Yeah. Well, you know, Professor Cartledge reminded me that, you know, people's feet back then were quite a bit different than our feet. You know, they had much tougher bottoms, you know, soles to their feet. So, you know, our feet have become very tender, you know, as we've evolved.
So as you do something like that, I mean, one of my favorite things, I love this connection between running and history. Like, one of my sort of travel hacks is that whenever I get to a city, a new city I haven't been to, I go and I run around it, and I like to read all the historical signs, or I'll find something like, oh, here's this famous statue and it's 6 miles from my hotel. So I'll run there, look at the statue, and then come back. I also do this because my wife hates looking at the signs, and so then I can sort of get it all done on my time, and then we can hang out and do whatever we want to do in the city. But I really do love the connection of feeling like people have done what I'm doing in this place before. Like, remember I got up early one morning in Rome, and I went for this run, and I'm running around, and then I found myself, I was in the Circus Maximus, which, you know, because it's such a state of disrepair, you can just get in and walk around it. And so, you know, running around this thing that, you know, people have been racing horses and humans in for, you know, again, 2000 years, there is something special about feeling that sort of energy coming up from the ground or the surroundings or the place that you're in. Did you feel that on the way to Sparta?
Oh, without a doubt. I mean, well, you know, that's my ancestral roots are from that region. Mm-hmm. So I felt a pretty deep connection with the land. And I mean, you know, you start at the base of the Acropolis with the sunrise, and, you know, you've got chills, your knees almost buckle, you know, and it's so emotional, that particular region. And, you know, just knowing that literally a gentleman 2,500 years ago stood in that very same position and basically did the same thing I did, but under, you know, much more threatening circumstances, it was phenomenal.
And it's like, as much as everything's changed, you know, you're probably on paved roads at good points, you're hearing airplanes fly above, you know, you've got your modern running shoes on. At the core of it, that feeling that you felt, you know, probably 20 miles in or 100 miles in, you're wrestling with that voice, you're getting tired, you're getting hungry, you're getting thirsty. That, you know, as different as your feet are than his, as you were saying, that feeling is still fundamentally unchanged and will be for the same forever.
Yeah, I mean, the kind of raw emotions that you feel when you're running great distances, I don't think, you know, those are unique to that sort of endeavor, and it, you know, that will never go away, regardless of how much modern footwear we have. You know, unless they figure out a way to, you know, make us e-legs like an e-bike.
Yeah.
You're always going to feel those things when you're running 150 miles.
So when you run, do you listen to music?
You know, I don't, Ryan. Sometimes I listen to music. Mostly I just, you know, if it's a shorter run, like 1 or 2 hours, I try not to listen to anything. Mm-hmm. Because inevitably I start thinking. And, you know, again, we talked about, you know, the thoughts you have when you're running. But I also have about 500 audiobooks on my playlist. So I listen to probably 2 or 3 books a month.
So you do audiobooks when you run?
A lot of times I do, yeah.
Do you find that you can retain it? I'm always amazed. Like, I can't do audiobooks and I can't do podcasts when I'm working out. My mind is in a not that kind of receiving mode.
Only, you know, if I'm working out, I you know, with like HIIT training or, you know, even cycling, I can't quite get into an audiobook the way I can when I'm running. Hmm. And, you know, when I'm running, sometimes I'm out for 6 or 8 hours training. And, you know, I never run the same route twice. So I'm always on a fresh new route and, you know, I'm running by myself and I can really tune into an audiobook. But to your point, I can't tell you how many audiobooks that I've listened to. I need to pick up this actual book.
Right.
Because some of the passages are so good. So I inevitably, you know, end up buying the physical book as well.
For whatever reason, I have this weird quirk where I will find, even when I listen to music, I don't like listen to like shuffled music or a playlist or whatever. It's usually one song that I've selected like for that day or that I've been on a kick with for a week or so. And I listen to that same thing on repeat. And so it's kind of part of like getting into a zone where, you know, after 5 or 6 listens of a song, it kind of, it's not that it becomes background noise because you're still hearing it, but it kind of has blurred together. So you're just like in the song as opposed to the beginning of the song or the end of the song. It's just kind of in this loop. And that to me is very similar to the place you get when you're running, which is like you're just in it and you're fully sort of present and connected at the same time, kind of disconnected, almost out of your body, because like the body is in charge instead of the mind being in charge.
That's just weird, Ryan. I guess I'll have to try that, but that's the first time I've heard of that one.
I do the same thing when I'm writing. It's usually a song on repeat. It helps me just sort of check out and let something else take over. You know, like the Buddhists talk about willful will. You know, like when you're trying to be in charge, there's an intentionality there that isn't quite right. But when the training takes over or the instinct takes over, to me, that's more of a pure place.
Yeah, I mean, I think to me, writing is a delicate dance between, you know, making it happen and letting it happen.
Kind of. Yes, I love that.
Yeah, sometimes you feel like you're forcing it. And if you can just let go of that, it comes more, it flows more naturally.
Although that goes back to the same thing about running is like, how do you know when you gut it out versus like, this is not a day to force it? You know what I mean? Like, yeah. You know, because if you only write when you're inspired, for instance, you won't write enough. But if it's no fun and you're just, you know, sort of gritting your teeth and bearing it every day, probably what you're producing isn't right. So it comes back this weird balance.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's a quote in my new book. It's something like, you know, there are two ways to get to the finish of an ultra marathon. The first is to put your head down and grunt your way through it. And I don't know the other way. I mean, it pretty much always comes down to, you know, you're dancing at a point. I mean, the pain is, the numbness goes away and, you know, you feel like you could keep running around the world and, you know, 20 feet later, you know, you can barely get off the ground. So inevitably, you know, an ultra marathon becomes just struggle.
But that's something you learned early on, right? I was reading one of your, you did a race, maybe middle school or high school, and the coach asked you how it went, and you said, oh, it felt great. And he said, like, well, then you're not trying hard enough because it shouldn't feel great.
Yeah, and he said, if it felt great, you didn't try hard enough. It's supposed to hurt like hell. This is my seventh grade cross-country coach.
Is that true for writing also? I guess I find that it is like, there's a quote, like, a writer is someone to whom writing does not come easy. Like it, having the book is fun. Writing the book is a grueling grind.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's 1% inspiration, 99% perspiration. You know, I think any writer that I've read about struggles with passages, you know, with just getting a sentence right, with getting the pacing right. But I think, you know, I tell this to my son all the time, that the best writers are the best readers. Mm-hmm. So if you're well read, I think that helps a lot because you learn about writing techniques from others that you can build into your books.
Yeah. And I think, you know, we often, you know, people confuse the sport or the artistic endeavor, like a book, with like the getting it down on the page, which of course is one of the marathons. But in fact, you know, like writing a book is actually several marathons, right? So like I finished my next book. I finished it in December. And today I just got the tracking from the publisher, like my second pass of the pages. Like, so the second set of designed pages will come in. And now I have to read this book for however many times this has been, probably 20, 30 times. I have to go through, edit it again. I can't, you know, I have to read it almost with a higher sort of set of standards than I did the last time. And it's, you know, I have to tweak more to get it maybe 1% better. And then after that, I still have to record the audiobook. Then I have to start gearing up for the marketing launch. And then I have to do the marketing launch. And then, you know, I also I'm on my schedule, like I'm supposed to start writing my next book tomorrow. That's like what's on my schedule. So, you know, I think one of the benefits of endurance sports is that idea of like, just when you think you're running out of gas, you're like at the halfway point or something. It's that, you know, it's not just the fun performance part of it that is the slog. It's all the other things that you have to do as part of it.
I couldn't agree with you more. And, you know, knowing you, it's hearing this is really kind of reassuring because I go through the same thing. And I just think of, you know, someone like you that I hold on a pedestal as just a, you know, just an icon of achievement, knowing that you are literally sitting in front of a computer, you know, for hours and hours and hours writing, it's kind of comforting, because unless you're an introvert, I don't know how other people do it. You know, you can't write a good book. You can't write any book without spending hours and hours in your own head.
Totally. Well, that's very nice of you to say. I do like to joke, like, you know, people be like, tell me about your book or something. And it's like, you know, if I could just tell you what this was, I never would have gone through this horrible experience of writing it. Like, my whole life is that I cannot explain to you what I think. I have to go write it in book form. You know, people go like, tell me what the new book's about. And you know, they want like a 2-minute answer. And you're like, if I had a 2-minute answer, I just would have done that. I wouldn't have spent 2 years and 300 pages getting this thing down.
You know what? I'm nodding my head in agreement with you. I don't, you know, people want the elevator pitch of your book, and you're like, geez, you know, if it was just an elevator pitch, you know, it'd be in a blog post or something, or just a,
right.
It'd be a tweet.
Or like, in, you know, in your case, like, you'd be like, so how long have you been working on the new book, Dean? And you're like, literally since I started running for the first time. Like, it's a lifetime of experience that you're then getting down on the page. So, yeah, I'm starting this new book tomorrow. But, like, I mean, the clock on this thing started, you know, the day I was born.
Yeah, that's really well said. Yeah. And, you know, the gratification for me is, like, this morning I got an email from a guy. He said, you know, last night I was going to read a couple chapters of your book before I went to sleep. And he said, 6 hours later, I finished the last page. And I thought, wow, it's amazing. He said, and then I got up. I just had to go for a run.
Ooh.
So,
yes.
I mean, getting messages like that kind of, you know, it makes it all seem worthwhile.
So talk to me about pacing in one of these insane races that you do. Because they're races, but they're also primarily races with oneself, right? Like, if you, it's more like, can you physically do it or not? That's the first leaderboard. And then second is like where you come in relation to other people. But one of the things that I find sort of consistently challenging about running is like, everyone else is out there running their own race. And how do you stay locked in on the race that you're trying to run, that you've mapped out, and not getting distracted by the misleading bursts of speed or bad strategies that the other racers are on?
Yeah, I mean, there's a saying, you know, plan the race and race the plan. So I kind of go into most races with somewhat of a plan. And to your point, it's really easy to, you know, to lock horns with someone else early on and run too hard. Because I've done it, you know, you learn through experience, and mostly bad experience. So I know the toll that takes. And I can't tell you how many times, you know, I've had people rocket past me and I felt like, oh, man, I'm so slow. And, you know, 75 miles later, they're on the side of the trail, you know, unable to get up. So a lot of it comes to patience and experience. But it's also a lot about problem solving. I mean, in an ultra marathon, you know, if things are going right, just give it a couple moments. Things are always going to go wrong. So, you know, how do you deal with various things breaking down? And that, again, you know, a lot of that comes through experience.
Yeah. One thing that I think about when I'm sort of running, but also in life, there's this beautiful passage in one of Seneca's essays. He talks about he says the key is to know what path you're on and to not be distracted or misled by the paths of the other peoples who crisscross yours. He said, especially the people who are lost. And the word he uses is euthymia, which basically just translates from Greek into ancient Greek into some word resembling tranquility. But I think he said it's like sort of knowing who you are, what you're trying to do, what you need to do to be able to accomplish that, and then to have the fortitude. This is a different kind of fortitude to be able to go like, it doesn't matter that this person who started on the finish line with me is ahead of me for now, because if I stick to what I planned out over the long run, eventually it will pay dividends. But that's going to require some discipline in the meantime to not throw that out just because it doesn't look like it's working at the beginning.
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't agree with you more. That's very well said. You know, the thing with ultramarathoning is that you get a lot of chances at redemption.
Sure.
Because there's going to be so many times where, you know, you're being passed, and then there are other times you're passing people. You know, there's a saying when you're catching up to someone, you're reeling them in. And I like to say, you know, some days you're a fisherman and other days you're a fish. So some days you're doing the reeling and some days you're getting reeled.
And it's we're talking about timeless wisdom. I mean, nothing proves the sort of moral of Aesop's fable about the tortoise and the hare more than, yeah, a race of any distance longer than a couple miles, where the person who got up and out of the gate fast inevitably wavers, and the person who just kept on keeping on and didn't quit has a chance over a long enough distance if they can sustain it.
Yeah, I mean, it comes back, another quote in my book is, you know, finishing an ultramarathon is simple. All you have to do is not stop.
That's what I joke. People go, you know, I've been with my wife now for 15 years. We've been married for 5, but we've been together. We're approaching the almost sort of halfway point of our, like, been together as at half the time we've been alive. And people are sort of like, what's the secret? And I like to just say, not breaking up. That's mainly the secret. Because there is no magical thing that just makes it easy. Like people go, oh, you know, I can't meet someone that I can settle down with. And it's like, you know, have you tried settling down with someone? Like it's, I'm not saying that, you know, your relationship with your spouse is an endurance sport that you just grit your teeth and put up with, but I'm also not saying that it's not that, because it kind of is.
You know, I mean, I think that a lot of people overlook that. I think of love is discipline and commitment, you know, forever faithful, you know, semper fidelis, forever faithful. It's not always pretty. It's like an ultra marathon. There are points where you want to give up and you're groveling. You're like, this is ugly. Like, why am I in this relationship? But, you know, if you stick to it, there's a certain magic in that. And I think that's very much overlooked in our society. And if you talk to, you know, older couples, like my parents have been married for over 50 years, and, you know, they say the same thing, you know, that thunder and lightning, you know, our marriage was created in heaven, but so was thunder and lightning.
Yeah. And this idea of like, you just don't quit, I think is true in a lot of the creative professions. And then I also think like the idea of not getting distracted by what other people are doing. Like when I look at the authors, for instance, that I really admire, it's, you know, it's like a Robert Caro, who's like, you know, in his 70s or 80s, still writing, still slogging away at the same series on Lyndon Johnson. You know, these books were epic ultra marathons of artistic genius and research. But I also love that they're still doing it. So, you know, sometimes you get jealous. You're like, oh, this book is off to a hotter start than mine. Or, you know, this guy's getting all the attention, so on and so forth. But you're like, no, 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 I want to do this for the long term. And I want to do this till I drop dead, right? And so that idea of sustainability, of not getting distracted, of sticking to your plan, regardless of what's happening, whether you're ahead or you're behind, sticking to your plan, that really is an important skill. And I think it was Murakami when he wrote this in What I Talk About When I Talk About Running, is that like it's running is both exercise and a metaphor, and you learn a lot from the metaphor.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. You know, running is such a simplistic act, right? I mean, you're just, you know, you're putting one foot in front of the other at an accelerated rate, but it's profound. And the lessons you learn, you know, extend way beyond the act of just moving your feet fast.
Do you ever feel your body breaking down on you? Like, is the runner today the same runner that was there 10 years ago? Or have you had to adjust the way that like a savvy veteran in the NBA has to compensate for, you know, the limitations of their body as they've gotten older?
Yeah, very much so. I mean, you know, I'm so much slower than I used to be. So to run the same times that I used to, you know, used to come easy, I've really got to work at it. And as well as, you know, I've pretty much said, like, I'm committed to doing the sport until, you know, my finish line is a pine box. So, how are you going to get there? And I just look at myself through the lens of being the best animal that I can be. And everything I do is through that lens. So, you know, when it comes to training, I don't compromise when it comes to training. I do not compromise when it comes to cross training. You know, my diet and nutrition is very regimented. You know, my sleep quality is best. You know, I try to optimize sleep quality as well as I try to optimize my interpersonal relationships. I think a lot of people overlook that, you know, if you have harmonious interpersonal relationships with your friends and family, your performance is inevitably better. And just the opposite holds true as well.
Right. So if you're up the night before a race arguing with your spouse over something, that's energy that's not going to be spent running. And it's also screwing with your sleep and so on and so forth.
I couldn't agree more. So, you know, making, you know, doing what you can to harmonize, you know, make your interpersonal relationships harmonious, I think is a really good thing for any athlete. And I don't think that's something many athletes focus on. But, you know, I've had to take this kind of 360 holistic approach to being the best Dean that Dean can be, you know, to keep up with my younger self.
So if your body is slower and you're still keeping up the same times that you used to post, how does that work? Where are you making up the difference? Is it just willpower or is it?
If you saw some of my data from some of my runs, you know, you'd be blown away. I routinely get my heart rate near or over 200. And I do that by, you know, running these really hard tempo runs, short, like 5 miles, just nose breathing. So, you know, the ancient Spartans, they used to, when they were training the young recruits, they used to make them run for 10 miles with water in their mouth. And they used to have to spit it out at the end of 10 miles. So they were into nose breathing. And I've been experimenting with that as a way to really, you know, jack up my my VO2 max, as well as, you know, basically my performance.
Interesting.
Have you ever tried nose breathing?
So my septum's all screwed up, so I'm like a mouth breathing idiot.
Yeah, and it is really tough. I couldn't imagine with that, you know, screwed up septum doing it, but even with a perfect nose, it really, really tests you.
So you're just sort of having to look for efficiencies inside your pacing and your running because you can't just coast by on sort of natural ability or youth anymore.
That's exactly right. And also, you know, the idea of training throughout the day So I don't, you know, to me, life is training and training is life.
Sure.
I don't compartmentalize and just say, okay, I've got to do my hour workout today. I mean, I'm constantly training throughout the day. I have this HIIT routine of body weight exercises with, you know, push-ups, pull-ups, chair dips, and burpees. And it's about a 12 to 14 minute routine. And I do that 5 or 6 times throughout the course of the day.
As well. Scheduled or just randomly?
Just randomly. Like I did one before this interview because I just felt like I was a little bit, you know, getting a little lethargic. And, you know, just throughout the course of the day when I'm feeling like my energy is ebbing, I'll just, you know, pop out a quick HIIT routine.
Got a quick message from one of our sponsors here, and then we'll get right back to the show. Stay tuned.
There's a lot of things we know would be good for us. Problem is, we don't have time. It's just tougher. I think therapy is like that. We all know that sitting down, talking to someone, really working on our issues will make a difference. So the problem is finding a therapist, driving across town, all of that, right? And that's where Talkspace comes in, today's sponsor. Because by doing everything online, Talkspace has made getting the help you want easier, more accessible, and more affordable. With Talkspace, you can sign up online and get a personalized match with a provider that's right for you, typically within 48 hours. You can have virtual sessions with your licensed therapist from the comfort of your home. And Talkspace is secure and private, using the latest end-to-end grade encryption to store client information and complying with the latest HIPAA regulations. As a listener of this podcast, you'll get $80 off your first month with Talkspace when you go to Talkspace.com/stoic and enter code SPACE80. To match with a licensed therapist today, go to Talkspace.com/stoic and enter promo code SPACE80, that's 80, to get $80 off your first month and show your support for the show. That's Talkspace.com/stoic, promo code SPACE80.
The Daily Stoic is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. One of the cool things about podcasts is that you can multitask while you're listening, but depending on what you're doing right now, like for instance, if you're not in some kind of moving vehicle, there's something else you could be doing. You could be getting an auto quote from Progressive Insurance. It's easy and you could save money by doing it right from your phone. Drivers who save by switching to Progressive save nearly $700 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Discounts for having multiple vehicles on your policy, being a homeowner, and more. So just like your favorite podcast, Progressive will be with you 24/7, 365 days a year, so you're protected no matter what. Multitask right now. Quote your car insurance at progressive.com to join over 29 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $698 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Yeah, I'm my next book is going to be about self-discipline. I'm doing a series on the four virtues. So I just did courage, and then the next one, self-discipline. And there's a Greek word, I'm forgetting it, but it basically it's about sort of the winning the battle of the higher self against the lower self. That's sort of what self-discipline is the higher self winning. I imagine, given everything that you accomplished, given how long you've been doing it, there would be this natural tendency to relax, right? Complacency, resting on one's laurels. But the second you do that and actually it might be interesting too, because, you know, not being in a team sport, there's even a greater temptation to relax because there's not the level of play and the system sort of keeping you in check. You must have to sort of retain this constant vigilance about your discipline to stay at the level that you stay at.
And, you know, it's funny. I never question it. I never once have quite, you know, you were talking, I'm thinking he's kind of right. Like I am such a disciplined actor, and I never I do not allow compromise. I mean, it's just black and white. You don't compromise on anything. And that, especially when it comes to diet, like I've just kind of said, here are the acceptable foods you'll eat, you know, and here are the foods you won't. And that's it. There's no such thing as a cheat day. Like you wouldn't even desire these other foods.
Is that a struggle for, like, does it count as self-discipline if it's not a struggle, or is it a struggle for you?
I think I've trained my mind for it not to be a struggle. I mean, I can walk past a bakery and, you know, the smells of a bakery usually just make you salivate. To me, I don't even, it doesn't even register with me. You know, eating a donut would be like eating a tennis ball to me. I have no desire for it whatsoever.
Yeah. So either there's some natural thing there, or you've transcended the contest altogether. Like, yeah, for instance, there's some stuff I don't like, right? So it's not a temptation, right? Like, I don't like alcohol, so like not drinking is not a struggle for me. But then there's other things that I would like to do, but I've transcended doing them.
Yeah, it's funny you say that, because, you know, Rich Roll's a good friend of mine.
I was just texting with Rich. Yeah.
Okay. You know, and I said to him one time, Rich, could we go have a beer right now? You know, he's a recovered alcoholic.
Right.
And he said, no, there's just no way that I couldn't do that. I'm like, Rich, you're so learned. Like, you know, you know so much about alcoholism and addictive personalities. Can't we just go have a beer, just one beer? And because I can just go have a beer and enjoy it and be done with it. And he just said, there's just no way. Like, I couldn't do that. It would lead to my destruction. And I just found that so curious.
Well, I think that that's what you sort of realize when you look at addiction, or you, it's like for some people they can do it, and some people you just can't do it. It's like a gene or a switch that just makes it impossible for you to do certain things in moderation. And sometimes that can be good. Sometimes that's really not good. But that's also the ego of like, oh, I have transcended it, so it's not a struggle. That's almost the darkest temptation. When you think you've mastered it, that's precisely when it gets you.
Yeah, well, let me ask you, do you have any vices that you're willing to share?
Yeah, no, I definitely do. I would say, for me, I have a sort of a compulsive sort of inclination. So I'm generally just really careful about the things that I do. So I don't drink. I don't like it, but I don't drink. It's never been a part of my life because, like, I know if I got to a place where I liked it, it would be compulsive. It's the same thing with drugs for me. I just have to have like sort of a hard line. Like, those things are not in the life. But I would say for me, the vice tends to be more, I don't know how I would express it, but it's typically associated more with work. So, like, and maybe this is true for you, like, whatever's happening in my life, you know, the reality of the world and Murphy's Law and other people and all of this stuff, my work is always simple and my work is always in my control. So, that's a good way to channel energy, but it also can become a way where, just as sort of anything that releases endorphins or generates pleasure or satisfaction or some sort of reward, that can become almost like a relief mechanism. So stuff is bad, I'll focus on work. Stuff is bad, focus on work. And so it kind of creates this almost Pavlovian thing where work is where you get relief, and then work can take on an outsized role of importance in your life. If that makes sense.
Yeah, it's almost like a shelter.
Yes. Yes.
A security blanket you just go to when the world, you know, is getting ugly.
Yeah, and so if I don't have it for a few days, I can feel like withdrawal effects. And even like with running, like, I can tell it is almost always harder for me to not run than it is to run. So, like, I need more willpower to say, today I am going to rest because I am sick, because, you know, it's my son's birthday and my family is in town and blah, 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 blah. It is easier for me to get up the willpower to go do the run, to get the relief, to get the endorphins, than it is to have the self-control to say, like, I'm going to sit here with this discomfort and not do it.
It's so funny because in August, I'm supposed to run across Australia and and I need to quarantine for 2 weeks on entry. And I'll say it's a hard quarantine where basically I go to a hotel room and I don't leave the hotel room. And the run across Australia, you know, the quarantine scares me more than the run.
Yes.
Like, how am I going to sit still for 2 weeks in a 200 square foot hotel room? So I completely relate to what you're saying. Like, it's harder for me not to work out than to work out.
Yes. Yes. And so that's why, that's sort of my point about self-discipline. I almost wonder, is it self-discipline? Although actually, have you read the new Sebastian Younger book?
No, I'm dying to read it. I haven't read it yet.
It's really good. I had him on the podcast. He was talking about how he basically walks across a good chunk of America. Yeah. He does this sort of backpacking trip. But he was saying, you know, you've gotten into the rhythm walking when it's easier to keep going than it is to stop. And and I think that's a place you can get to with running, with writing, with working, with any sort of task that you're dedicated to, where it's so soothing and relaxing and almost self-propelling to stay in the rhythm of it. Whereas to go spend 2 weeks in a hotel room in Australia, that's like a record scratch. Like, that's so abnormal, outside your normal experience, that in a weird way, that's going to be its own endurance event for you, and probably challenging in a bunch of good ways. You're going to have to figure out how not to go crazy in that hotel room.
How many burpees can I do?
Yes.
But I mean, I can relate to that feeling of, you know, finding this kind of groove and not wanting to, you know, get out of it. I mean, one time I ran 50 marathons in 50 states, and all of the 50 states in 50 consecutive days. And I finished in New York City, and I live in the San Francisco Bay Area. And afterward, after, you know, this 50 days of getting up every morning and run a marathon, I couldn't imagine, you know, just coming back to my house. So I just said to my wife, you know, I'm going to run home. She's like, you're going to run from New York to San Francisco. And I said, yeah, I am. And I literally bought a jog stroller and just put all my stuff in it, and it just started running, because it was like my new reality was just, you know, every morning getting up and running.
Well, you needed to decompress. It's like in the Hurt Locker. He's like, he just has to get back, even though it's insane and incredibly dangerous. You can kind of become addicted to the adrenaline and the rhythm of it. Again, I think because it's as insane as it is, there's a logic to it in a way that there isn't a logic to, like, having to go get your driver's license renewed at the DMV. That's like an insane world that you don't have any control over.
I so relate to that. I mean, to me, wandering, and to a lot of people, I think wandering is more natural and you feel more comfortable than going to the DMV, for sure. I mean, I think we came onto this planet as wanderers, and that's been taken away from us.
Yeah, I've found it's magical with my kids. Like this morning, I did a 4-ish mile run with both my kids in the double jogging stroller, and there's something sort of very primitively connective about that experience. And I found that, like, almost all behavioral issues with the kids can get, if not totally resolved, at least temporarily resolved by taking them for a walk of some form or another, or a run of some form or another, or a bike ride of some form or another.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a whole nother, you know, hot button of mine. But I think the way we raise our kids is inherently wrong. I mean, you know, we tell young boys to sit still and pay attention, but their very nature is to, you know, run wild and not pay attention.
Yeah.
So we kind of force them into this unnatural state, and no wonder they have behavioral problems. It's just, let them go running, let them go exploring.
Yeah, they should be running as the way that Chrysippus was running as a kid, or the Spartans were running as a kid. You can channel that energy into the form of activity, but yeah, the idea that you were supposed to sit, you know, for long extended periods of time in a classroom with a bunch of other kids is so insanely unnatural. That's what I felt with the pandemic, because I've got these young kids. It's like, people are like, oh, they didn't learn anything doing virtual learning. It's like, no, they probably learned more, not having to be forced into this artificial structure every day for the last 15 months.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and I hope you got them out into nature as well. I mean, I'm not sure.
No, we live out in the country, so we spent all day outside. We spent all day outside, even in the Texas summer. You know, they spent hours in the pool, hours walking through the woods. Like, it was, you know, it was much more of an immersive experience than school, and it was great.
Yeah, no, I mean, my earliest childhood recollections are running home from kindergarten. And I literally, I mean, I so loved relating to the world at 6 miles an hour. I remember the leaves changing color. I remember the way the air felt on my skin. I remember the ducks that came to this one lake. And, that to me was so much more valuable than, sitting in a classroom.
Totally. Totally. And unfortunately being around such other unhealthy kids, right? Like one of the weird things about the last year has been no one in my family has gotten sick. Not COVID. Like it's been nice not getting COVID, but it's also been nice not getting, hand and mouth disease or, like whatever these god awful things that you bring home from daycare.
And even the sniffles. Yeah. I mean, you're so right. I think our immune systems have benefited from the lockdown.
Well, I loved the new book. I love the journey that you've been on. And, I'm very curious to see where it goes. Cause I think that's the other thing that I say is like the real marathon is doing it over the course of one's life. You hear people, I'm training for a marathon, and I always go, that's great. You should, good for you. I hope you do it. But like to train for something as this one-off that you do and then stop, to me is less of a feat than like, what kind of rhythm can you get in and what can you cumulatively accomplish, sort of day in and day out. And I think that's really the marathon that you're on. That's the ultimate endurance thing. It's not that you did 50 marathons in 50 days. It's that was 1 mile in a multi-mile, sort of race career for you of these insane feats of endurance.
Yeah. I mean, I've now raced and competed on all 7 continents twice over. So, find what you love and let it kill you.
Well, I hate this question, but I'm going to ask you, what is the next thing for you? Like, do you have a sort of a mountain that's there that you feel like you haven't tackled? Is there some sort of feat of human endurance that is there in the distance that you're trying to figure out a way to do?
Yeah. So, funny you should ask. I'm planning to run from the lowest point on Earth to the highest point.
Oh.
So from the Dead Sea to the top of Everest.
Wow. It literally or like how does that work?
Yeah, not virtual. I mean, literally.
Running. No, I mean, they'll go like, we're swimming across the Great Lakes, but they're really doing it like in the pool. Like, you mean you'll start in the Dead Sea and then you'll culminate by climbing Everest?
Yes. Yes.
Wow. Probably not at much of a running pace, I imagine. For Everest.
Yeah, no, not for Everest. And, it'll be interesting to see the way this comes together. How much I have to do it self-supported versus having, access to like a support vehicle or something.
But, sure.
I'd love to do the whole thing self-supported. I just don't know how practical that'll be.
Yeah, you might need a Sherpa, right?
I'm certainly not going to run up Everest in my running gear.
Well, that's amazing. I'm so glad I've been a fan of your stuff for a long time. We've never connected. I'm so glad we finally did this.
Yeah, likewise, Ryan. And how many books are you on? What number will this be?
I actually lose count, which is usually a good sign when I'm running as well. Like when I lose track of the miles, it means I'm really locked in. But I think it's 11. It could be 12. And then I already know like the next 3. So I'm just sort of in that zone where you're just like, I got so much work and so much far ahead of me that it's not really worth counting too closely because that just makes you tired.
Just take it one sentence at a time, one word at a time.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Just like one of the things I like when I got an Apple Watch, it's helped me as a swimmer because now I don't have to count the laps anymore. It's just like happening, And then I can get lost in the, like, I'm just doing this for a long time as opposed to like, is this 55 laps or 56? Something's doing that for me.
Yeah. You can let your mind wander then. And totally. I guess you probably enjoy the swim itself more when you don't have to count.
Yeah. And I think as a writer, it's like, as long as you're always working, you're always noodling on something, that's better than like, what should I do next?
Well, you've done an incredible job keeping them all fresh and different, as far as the themes and the content. So, don't stop.
Well, thanks.
It sounds like you're not. You have no intention of stopping, which is fantastic.
No, you said it well. Find what you love and let it kill you. Because you're going to, you know, actually, that's a good place to stop. Because you said earlier you want to keep doing this till you, you know, the finish line is a pine box. What I think so profound about that, and this is what the Stoics would say, is like, you don't, it's a fantasy to think, oh, the pine box is when I'm old, right? Because you don't actually know. The finish line is when you end up in a pine box, and you inevitably will end up in a pine box. It could be 3 weeks from now. It could be 30 years from now. It could be due to radical life extension. It could be 100 years from now. But invariably, you'll end up in the box. So you should do what you love, and you should do it well, and not cheat yourself or the sport by half-assing it.
Yeah, I mean, hopefully it's a few years down the road, but you're absolutely right. It, this could be the last interview I ever give. I could walk out the door and get hit by a truck. So you never know.
I love it. Well, man, thanks. I'll record the intro after this, and this may actually run tomorrow. I'm excited to put it up.
Wow, that's fantastic. I appreciate it. You're a great guy, and I hope we can run together one day. I'd love to meet you in Greece somewhere.
I would definitely. I would love to do that. We'll figure out a race to do in Greece. That would be so cool. And I was going to ask you. I saw you posted those shoes today. Those looked awesome.
Yes, they're $375. They better be awesome.
Yeah, they better be.
Yeah, no, they're amazing. I mean, these guys said, they said, you know, they were footwear designers, and they just said, we're sick of compromise. We're just going to make the best shoe possible. It's going to cost a lot, but we're not going to compromise with materials or anything. And they did a great job.
How hard is the bottom? I couldn't tell by looking at it. Cause the one thing I love / hate about Texas is I feel like it has the sharpest rocks of anywhere in America. And so I couldn't tell, are those pretty thick bottoms?
Yeah, and there's a carbon fiber plate in there as well.
Oh. Like
a protective plate. So the plate, you can take it in or out, but if you're in a rocky terrain, you would keep it in.
All right, well, I'm going to check this out. They look sick.
Yeah, they're pretty amazing. Yeah.
Awesome. All right, man. Well, I'll let you go, and we'll talk soon.
You take care, brother. We'll be in touch.
Thanks for listening to the Daily Stoic Podcast. Just a reminder, we've got signed copies of all my books in the Daily Stoic store. You can get them personalized. You can get them sent to a friend. Whatever you want, we'd love for you to have a copy. I know I love signed copies of some of my favorite books. If you love a signed copy of The Obstacle is the Way, Ego is the Enemy, Stillness is the Key, the leather-bound edition of the Daily Stoic, we have them all in the Daily Stoic store, which you can check out at store.dailystoic.com. Hey, Prime members, you can listen to The Daily Stoic early and ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen early and ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Guy Raz's How I Built This is a podcast where each week he talks to the founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn the real stories of how they built them. In each episode, you hear these entrepreneurs really go into their story. And Guy is an incredible interviewer. He doesn't just dance around the surface. He has real questions because he himself is an entrepreneur. He's built this huge show and this huge company. In a recent episode, they talked to the founder of Liquid Death, that crazy water company that's become this billion-dollar brand. Follow the show on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to How I Built This early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. And for a deep dive in daily business content, listen to Wondery Destination for Business podcasts with shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more. Wondery means business.
You know, if I would have applied myself, I could have gone to the NBA.
You think so?
Yeah, I think so. But it's just like, it's been done. You know, I don't want to be a follower. Hi, I'm Jason Concepcion.
And I'm Shea Serrano. And we are back. We have a new podcast from Wondery. It's called Six Trophies.
Woo!
And it's the best.
Each week, Shea Serrano and I are combing through all the NBA storylines, finding the best, most interesting, most compelling stories, and then handing out six pop culture themed trophies for six basketball related activities.
Trophies trophies like the Dominic Toretto I Live My Life a Quarter Mile at a Time trophy, which is given to someone who made a short-term decision with no regard for future consequence.
Or the Christopher Nolan Tenet trophy, which is given to someone who did something that we didn't understand.
Catalina Wine Mixer trophy.
Ooh, the Lauryn Hill You Might Win Some But You Just Lost One trophy. And what's more, the NBA playoffs are here, so you want to make Six Trophies your go-to companion podcast through all the craziness. Follow Six Trophies on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. Listen ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.